Now it is my pleasure to invite our second speaker, Stephen Haynes. Stephen is the head of politics and international relations at the Royal Holloway College. Until 3 years ago, Peter was on the central policy staff of the Ministry of Defence, United Kingdom. He wrote the UK Strategic Doctrine in 2001. He is chairman of the editorial board of the United Kingdom Law of Armed Conflict Management. Manual. And he is also a former Royal Navy officer, as our third speaker, Robert Green. Peter.
Stephen. Thanks very much indeed. Very, very kind indeed. And I'm really, really very, very happy indeed to be here. And thanks very much indeed to George Fairbrother for inviting me. I've been to several gatherings of people who are interested in the abolition of the nuclear dimension within the international system in the UK and around about. And I'm very, very happy indeed always to attend and throw into the discussion a slightly different approach and a slightly different view. I never feel, I have to say, although I've joked a little bit this morning about being Daniel in the lion's den, I never feel that because I always have a great deal of interaction with those that I'm talking with, and I'm always very, very welcome in these groups, even though my views differ in certain respects quite profoundly from the views of most of the people that I'm speaking to. One of the great regrets to me in this whole business is that, as one or two people have already made comment about this morning, we're not that far away from NATO headquarters here. I suspect, although I haven't met everybody here today, but I strongly suspect that there isn't a single representative of the NATO staff here in the room, although, as I said, I might be wrong. If you are there, put your hand up and we'll all like to identify you. It's sadly the case that we have a situation in which two sides of a particular debate very rarely, if ever, engage with one another. And I am doing my little bit, in a sense, to provide some sort of a grit in the oyster, if you like, in the context of that debate. What I thought I'd do today, and I didn't make up my mind what I was going to say until a short while ago, I said to George, what do you want me to talk about? And he said, well, it's up to you, really. And I thought, well, I'll just sense the tenor of the meeting and come out with one or two things that I hope will provoke some, presumably, dissent, but also some serious and constructive discussion. I'm both an international lawyer by academic training and also an international relations specialist as head of an international relations department. This is a rarity in the UK. In the United States, it's very common. Quite a large number of political scientists, as they call themselves, are also lawyers. Quite a lot of politicians are lawyers. In the United Kingdom, that's not necessarily the case. And actually, international law and international relations very rarely get dealt with by those who are single operators in both fields. But I look at the I look at international law very much from an international politics perspective, which to many international lawyers probably means that what I'm about to say isn't worth very much. But I hope it's not seen that way. What I like to do is I like to put international law into the context of the international system. And what I believe about nuclear weapons is based on my own understanding and my own assessment of the international system. I don't think one can seriously consider the role and the function, the wisdom or the idiocy, if you wish, of nuclear weapons unless you do have some understanding of where the international system is, what the nature of that system is, and how we should go about coping with it. When I teach my students, I talk to them about the international system, which I regard as essentially it's about power. This is a fact of life, I think. It's about patterns of power, and how those patterns of power flux, how they move, how they shift, how they develop over time. And a very good starting point, although it's not necessarily the only one, for looking at the international system, of course, is the mid-17th century, Peace of Westphalia, the emergence of what we've come to know as the Westphalian state system. And there are various trends within that system over the last 300 or 400 years that are easily identified by the historians. And we are currently still in that Westphalian state system. I have some problems with that. But I like to think of where we are and where we're going. And to cut a very long story short on this, one thing that I will say is that there was a massive feature of that international system for almost its entire existence up to the middle of the last century, and that was great power war. Great power war was a blight on the landscape in many ways, and it came, of course, to a really atrocious pinnacle in the 20th century. In both the First World War and the Second World War in particular, great power war tore the world apart. Interestingly, though, there has not been a great power war now since 1945. Why should that be the case? I'm not going to sit here and say emphatically that the reason for that is that we had a nuclear balance for most of that period. I don't know whether that is a fact or not. However, I strongly suspect that it was a major factor in the reason why we are able to sit here this afternoon in a European Parliament, which is the focal point of the political activity of those former great powers that used to spend an inordinate amount of their time tearing each other apart on the battlefields of Europe. What has happened in Europe over the last 50 or 60 years is quite incredible. It is, I think, a massively positive thing, which augurs well for the development of the international system in the future. The problem is, of course, that it is largely confined in the present intensity of the EU to the European continent. I think the international system is developing. It's moving. It's shifting. Things are changing. I think great power relations, it depends how you define great powers, but certainly great power relations these days are not about fighting wars, certainly not between great powers. The patterns of power are shifting. Military power, I think, for all to see in Iraq, is showing itself up to be a blunt instrument. It is not anything like as effective as the amount of money that is spent on it would seem to suggest. Military power is something that has to be used carefully, and it has to be used with wisdom. And personally, I have to say, and I disagree obviously with the official UK line on this, I'm 3 years out of the system anyway, I don't believe we should have gone into Iraq. It made no sense to me, and I think it was fundamentally flawed, not only from a legal point of view, but also from a strategic point of view. The international system is changing. The nature of war has been changing. Certainly over the last 50 or 60 years, and certainly since the end of the Cold War, what we know of as war, the sort of war that I've seen the results of myself in places like Sierra Leone and Kosovo, is not very pleasant to behold. And I think warfare is something that any sane person wants to see reduced, both in terms of quantity and in intensity. And that is what I personally am committed to. I have to, however, warn that the international system is by no means a system of certainties. We are in a process of change, a state of flux in that system. The system is shifting. I think it's shifting in some very positive ways, despite what has happened over the last 5 or 6 years. We have globalization. We have integration. I've already mentioned the EU. I think that augurs well for the future in other regions of the world, but it certainly hasn't covered the rest of the world yet. We have the normative dimension. If anybody thinks that international law doesn't count, and there are, of course, one or two people who do feel that, then the debate and the criticism that has been generated as a result of the British and American decision to go into Iraq is proof positive, in my view, that international law certainly does matter. There is no doubt at all that the law issue in the UK has had a very damaging impact indeed on the standing of our Prime Minister and the popularity of his government. So the normative dimension of the international system is very important in a way that it probably wasn't in the 19th century, a very positivist century, normative issues. It was state sovereignty that mattered. International law was based on the consent of states and that just about all. But now we have an international legal system that includes a lot of other things, and one only has to look at, for example, the ICJ's ruling in the Barcelona traction case and consider the extent to which what states do within their own borders these days is not necessarily their own business and nobody else's. Human rights law is a new body of law, in effect, since the middle of the 20th century. All of these things are meaning that the international system is changing. And we have to, therefore, I think, place whatever we think about nuclear weapons in that process of change. The international system is, I believe, changing. I think it's changing for the better. I'm not entirely optimistic. And because I'm not entirely optimistic, I'm very cautious. I think there is less of a need for nuclear weapons than we thought there was some years ago. But I don't believe that the need for them has disappeared altogether. 3 or 4 years ago, when I was in the Central Policy Staff, the Minister of Defence, I was involved in the analysis that we were doing to do with the Kashmir crisis involving India and Pakistan. I came away from that analysis absolutely convinced that the existence or the presence of nuclear weapons, the nuclear dimension in South Asia, effectively reduced the possibilities of conventional war for two reasons. India and Pakistan both knew that they had that capability. To what extent was not entirely clear. And I can tell you that the only reason that we were doing the analysis in London, and similar analysis was being done in Washington, and we were engaged with the Pakistani and Indian governments over this in order to try and reduce the tension in the region, was because of the nuclear dimension to it. If that nuclear dimension had not been there, I do believe that there was a very, very strong chance indeed of India and Pakistan going to war over Kashmir. That did not happen. And I think it's too pat, frankly, to assume that just because the obvious effects of a nuclear explosion would be so profound, that nuclear weapons are invariably, always 100% a bad thing. I personally believe they are responsible for having kept a reasonable peace in Europe for over half a century. I also personally believe that they are capable of preserving peace in certain circumstances not involving great powers. Depends how you define powers. You may regard India as a great power. It's certainly emerging as one. But I do believe that there is some value in these weapon systems. And I have to say that I find it very sad that the two sides of this debate almost flatly refuse to talk to one another. I was at a debate, or so-called debate, at the London School of Economics a couple of months ago. My debater, the person I was debating with, was the current chairman of CND. I had no debate with her at all. She wouldn't engage. She read out a prepared script and would not debate at all. I was perfectly happy to engage, to discuss, to exchange views, to relate to her, go and have a glass of wine with her afterwards. She wasn't interested. Now, I'm going to tell you now that there are problems on both sides of this debate in that sense. The fact that there is nobody, well, I do know one person in the room who comes from the UK Ministry of Defence, and it's up to him whether or not he wishes to identify himself. But the fact is that this is not the sort, this is not a debating chamber today. It's a chamber in which most people are agreeing with each other. I think that's rather regrettable. Let me just go on and talk a little bit about one or two of the legal things. I think the problem that I've always had with the ICJ advisory opinion is, first of all, I believe that it was ill-conceived in the first place, asking the ICJ to give an advisory opinion on the question that was posed. The question was far too broad-ranging. It wasn't narrow enough. It wasn't focused enough. You weren't asking a particular question. It was just too broad. I also think, and I'm clearly going to defer to the Honourable Judge of the ICJ who's here today, but I do suspect, and I would be very surprised if the court didn't do this, that the court was probably faced with something of a dilemma, because if it had come down firmly one side or the other in response to that question, then it may well have been leading to its own undermining. Because there isn't any doubt in my mind at all that even if the ICJ advisory opinion had said that nuclear weapons are emphatically illegal, and that their use, the threatened use of them, etc., 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 is counter to international law, that there would have been a firm ignoring of that advisory opinion. There is no possibility that the United Kingdom, the United States, France, and the other nuclear powers are going to take a blind bit of notice of a ruling that turns around and says that nuclear weapons are illegal. And one of the problems I think you have in the anti-nuclear field is that they're not going to take any notice of you either. And I think part of the reason for that is that, and I like and regard as friends members of this group and this movement. Part of the problem I think you have is that you're unrealistic in your objectives. You need to think very carefully about what is practical and what is possible. At the moment in the United Kingdom, we're having a bit of a debate over the future of the British strategic nuclear deterrent. And I'm sorry for using the word deterrent, I'm sure we can have a good discussion about that later. I have a very, very simple view of this. First of all, I don't believe that Trident needs replacing. I think that it's got some years in it yet, and there isn't any need for an immediate decision on this. But even if there were to be a need for an immediate decision, I believe the United Kingdom has got an excellent opportunity to reduce its capability. There is absolutely no need, in my mind, for four Trident boats or equivalent boats, the Vanguard class, and the number of missiles and warheads and the warhead configuration that we've got at the moment. There is, I think, an ideal opportunity for us to scale down significantly the UK nuclear deterrent. I believe it's responsible for the United Kingdom to continue possessing a nuclear deterrent because I believe the international system is one in which I would be happier with the United Kingdom at that top table, not for any reasons of national pride, but I do believe we bring a responsible voice to that top table. You may disagree. I personally believe we bring a responsible view to that top table, or can do in the future. So reduce it. But can I get anybody in the anti-nuclear business to argue the case around Whitehall that we should be reducing? I can't get anybody to do it. Nobody is arguing this case in the UK at the moment. The arguments are going on within Whitehall, within the Treasury, within the Ministry of Defence, and the Foreign Office. If I expect the anti-nuclear movement in the United Kingdom to give up its absolute requirement for complete and total disarmament, I don't think I'll manage it. But I do believe that there is a role here for those who think this through. I believe that the Treasury, the Chancellor, would find it extremely difficult if there emerged in the UK debate today a consensus that the United Kingdom needed a much less capable deterrent than the one that it has got at the moment. But that debate is not being raged. That debate is not raging because the two sides in the debate who are occupying extreme ends of it are not talking to each other. I think that's very sad. And I think there is a role there for a responsible debate about progressive reduction in nuclear weapons that isn't taking place because the anti-nuclear lobby isn't wanting to engage in it. It's simply, it's all or nothing. And I frankly think that's impractical and it won't produce a result. As for the question of whether or not this issue should go to the ICJ again, my feeling on that is this, that one of the things that the ICJ studiously ignored or avoided almost entirely when it was considering its advisory opinion 10 years ago was the issue of deterrence. In fact, it stated that it wasn't going to address the policy of deterrence. Let me say for one thing, anybody who is looking at the legal consequences or the legal debate surrounding nuclear weapons who does not address the policy of deterrence is living on a planet that I don't inhabit. That is what these weapons have been used for over half a century. And to ignore the issue of deterrence and what role it plays in the international system is frankly barking mad to me, with all due respect to the Honourable Judge present. If it goes back to the ICJ, I cannot imagine that deterrence will not be an issue to be discussed. If it is, then I would refer you to Stephen Schwebel's dissenting opinion, in which he makes a very powerful argument that deterrence is a fundamentally part of customary law. Certainly, it is part of state practice. And if one argues, and the part of my argument would be, and I haven't got time to expand on it too much this afternoon, but part of my argument is that you have to, I think, in holding my position, I understand why it's so difficult for others to hold this position, is that I do believe that the use of nuclear weapons is a use that doesn't involve their actual use, that they balance, they deter, and they are not used. Now, in that sense, I suppose I have some sympathy with Kenneth Waltz's argument in his famous or infamous, depending on which side of the debate you're on, Adelphi paper of about 20 years ago on nuclear weapons, more, maybe better. I think there's some very powerful arguments in that, as indeed there are in Carl Sagan's opposing views, published very conveniently in a little book with both arguments in them just recently. There are big issues to debate here, and there's lots of issues that it would take a lot longer than 20 minutes to cover, and I think I've probably abused my time slot anyway and gone over the limit. I'll probably leave it there. I'm delighted to be here. It's a pity that I've got to leave later on this evening to get back to my department. I can't be here tomorrow. I am always very much invigorated by these sessions that I attend, and I throw what I've said into the pond and hope the ripples will have some effect, and very happy to answer questions after we've all finished speaking. Thanks very much indeed.
Well, thank you very much, Stephen. I think you've put the cat among the pigeons, I think. But I can certainly take your point about the fact that a lot of us speak to the converted, and I think the fact that we do not have an ongoing dialogue on a kind of a permanent scale between the disarmament activists like us and the pro-nuclear weapons establishment, I think, is something that we should really correct. Although I might say that IPPNW, which is the International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War, has what we call dialogue with decision makers. And so we go to the FCO and to Moscow and to Washington, and we talk with the government and departments about our view, and we have a dialogue. But perhaps we ought to perhaps enlarge on that. But that's a point I think we should take at this meeting. Well, thank you very much.
Of the threat of use of nuclear weapons. It was organized by the International Fishing 21st of July 2006 at Radio Miss Corsa Studios in Belgium.